Hello, I'm Jamie Sanchez, and I totally think railguns are a scam.
I'm Lauren Fates, and I love Googling numbers.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome back, bounty hunters, to another episode of the Bebop Beat. We're so glad you tuned into today's episode, Binary Two-Step. But before we dive into it, what's new, Lauren? We got any news for anybody?
I don't have any, like, Bebop fandom news, but I do have a Bebop anecdote, and that is that my mother... Okay, I'm an adult woman. I'm in my mid-30s. My mother still asks me for a Christmas list every year, and I give her one, I concede. And I ask for a lot of practical stuff, like, I would like some new kitchen towels. I would like some new bed sheets. But I've just vaguely put Cowboy Bebop stuff at the bottom because we're doing this podcast and it would be really fun to have some merch. So it's really strange because I grew up, obviously, in my childhood home watching Cowboy Bebop. You'd think my parents would be aware of what Bebop was and what it looked like. But no, my mother apparently Googled Cowboy Bebop things in hopes of finding some stuff to buy, and she decided to inform me she thinks Spike Spiegel looks like my high school boyfriend.
Oh my God.
And I was like, thanks, Mom. She's like, how is he? Like, fine, I guess. She's like, I could tell why you liked him. He looks just like Spike. That looks just like your high school boyfriend. I was like, I take it back. Don't buy me anything.
Well, that's not a conversation you're hoping to get into when you're building a Christmas wish list. Like, what a strange place to go.
No, and it's fine. I just don't need her buying anime merch if she's thinking about someone from my far, far past while she buys it.
Well, it's been all quiet on my front. I'm glad that we got to talk about this episode today because I gotta say, guys, it doesn't look good. I was thinking maybe it was just the first watch through. Everything was very different. I wasn't feeling really confident about where they were taking characters, but nope. On the second watch through, I feel equally annoyed with this episode and I can't wait to dig into it with all of you.
Yes, this is Binary Two-Step. And during my first watch through, this was my least favorite episode. I'm gonna try not to be too mean today. And I know we will actually get some awesome help on the back half of this episode because we have an amazing interview with Jade Harlow, the actor who plays Mel. I think Mel is one of the shining stars of not just Binary Two-Step, but the entire Netflix reimagining. We're so glad we got to talk to her. And in the meantime, I can just complain and whine that I think the visual in this one kind of looks like Mario Paint or something. It's not my favorite.
So I guess let's dive into it, yeah?
Sure.
We open with Jet and Mel in the engine room. He's talking to his mechanic. He's getting a lead from Radical Edward that's saying something like, CY Baba is now going by the name Londas. And right away, we're just knee deep in exposition, right? We've got the ship is broken, as it always is, but even worse because they're grounded. And we know that this is a Londa's focus episode from Brain Scratch.
When I first saw Mel, I imagined that maybe they were doing a twist on Doohan. And that's not true. Supposedly, there's a Doohan Easter egg elsewhere in the Netflix. And so this is truly an original character. She is mocking how Jet cares for the Bebop. And we're led to believe she's right, even though we're kind of leaning into the mechanic stereotype. Jet says she's a scammer who wants to overcharge him. She is finding legitimate and dangerous problems with his half-assed repairs. It reminds me of like someone buying a house and finding all of the like crappy electrical work or bad fixes the previous owner did. But it's like the previous owner is also staring over your shoulder while you find these things.
I appreciated the scene because it reminds us that Jet's just a frugal asshole at times. He's still got that in him. But it also sets the stage for the kind of manicness this episode creates later on. There's two different things going on simultaneously, and we as viewers are trusted to kind of follow both plot lines simultaneously. But I don't know if it pays off. We'll get into that.
Something I want to touch on right away just to sort of get this beef out in the open, is I said in the opening of this episode, I love Googling numbers. And that's because I spent a lot of time during Binary Two-Step doing just that. We learned from some of our previous guests that these episodes are just packed wall to wall with Easter eggs. And I have to assume that anything we see on the screen was put there with intent. Every number that came up during this episode, I Googled. The first one being 85XRSCV, which is the number at the beginning of this like file name that Radical Edward sends to Jet. Nothing really came up when I Googled that. Psalm 85 from the literal Bible did. I don't think that's what they were going for. But I just kind of want to start a conversation about how good, Jamie, or how useful do you think Easter eggs are when they're sort of opaque? Because this is the first of at least four or five that I tried to dig into and couldn't necessarily find. It's not like the serial number on the Enterprise or the nuclear codes from War Games. Whatever these things are, they're not for us.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think there's a way to handle this cinematography-wise to make sure that we're paying attention to it in some sense if you wanted to see it captured on screen. But as you mentioned in a previous episode, some of these things are so tucked away or they don't get their due on camera that we know it's there, we just can't make it out. And so who is this actually for? I found at some points in this episode, these things being distracting, taking away from our characters, taking away from the action. But I could see the love and the passion that everyone had to put these things in, given the quantity and the frequency in which they occur.
Right. But I don't necessarily think it's always love or passion for some pop culture thing we all recognize. This episode, more than any, is also packed with names. There's a street where we see Eklar, Ardo, Pete's, Tony's, Woo's, Mark Alexander. Every single business has this same naming convention where it's someone's name. And I'm led to believe that those aren't anyone we'd recognize, but like cast and crew members or loved ones, when I was just waiting to see our three old guys and didn't get them.
I'm half expecting this to be some kind of like escape room-esque pattern. Like maybe this is the name of a bunch of crew or actors from a movie that this is paying homage to, right? Like that's the level of obscurity that I'm kind of sensing while watching this episode and other ones that come after it.
Agreed. So I'm going to put that on the shelf for now and ask a different question, which is, why do we think Radical Edward is helping the Bebop crew? It was really delightful to see Ed asserting herself into the story. It pretty much confirmed, like, all right, she's going to be here at some point this season. But, you know, spoiler alert, we never get to meet her beyond that sting at the end of season one. So there is no setup for her. Like, she's a big fan of these bounty hunters. She really admires them. She's trying to get on the ship. Do you think that's still the reason they might go with?
I think that's a possibility. They are trying to build some trust with her by introducing her as this informant. That's actually her role in jamming with Edward. She does become this informant for MPU. But I also think that Brain Scratch fundamentally as an episode does lean into Edward style storytelling, right? Towards the end, we find out that she has this kind of empathy for Ronnie, the kid who ends up incapacitated. And it actually bothers me that they chose to tell the story without that angle. I thought it really gave Brain Scratch an empathy to the episode that we wouldn't get otherwise.
You're absolutely right. I think we give a lot of grace to the remixing overall. We've talked since episode one or two, frankly, about, wow, this wasn't Teddy Bomber's story, but it's still a Teddy Bomber story. Is it cool that it's still Teddy Bomber? And so on and so on. In this case, I think using Londis in a story that is not about this lonely child is truly an injustice to one of Bebop's strengths. Normally, I'd still be willing to say, well, okay, they replaced it with something good. If they slotted in a story that was still entertaining or compelling in a different way, fine, I can buy that. But Landes is sort of sacrificed in this one to the service of a Spike and Julia story. A Spike and Julia story that really hypes up the importance and truth of their love. Throughout the course of this episode, Spike just can't let Julia go. And this episode wants us to believe it's worth it. And when they're together, it's going to be fulfilling some destiny that is not only unavoidable, but good, because loving Julia literally saves Spike here. And then Julia has the heel turn that she has at the end of this series. And you're like, what's it all for?
I'm so glad you went there. Not only is this story Landa's, it is MPU. We're telling the story of MPU, a rogue AI that's, you know, got to make a connection with people or at least remove their souls from their bodies in this case. But I would say because they chose to tell the story in this manner, to display Spike and Julia's connection in a recurrent manner, not only does this story a disservice for sure, but Spike Spiegel is boring. When have you ever watched any Bebop episode or even fanfic, even some good fanfic for that matter, where Spike Spiegel's been boring? I hated it.
Oh, I don't know if I agree with boring. I think John Cho does his best to do some like heavy romantic lifting here. And in my opinion, he pulls it off at least half the time, maybe more than half the time. I don't know if I'd call him boring so much as I would call him uncharacteristically foolish. We know Spike is sort of laissez-faire, whatever happens, happens. But I don't believe he would just lie down in a chair that is so clearly meant to grab you with like 40 arms, you know? I think he'd think twice.
That's true. And not only that, though, we as viewers are watching this Groundhog Day scenario, right? It's the premise is you have to relive this experience over and over and over again until you, quote, get it right. And as a storytelling mechanic, I get that they chose this format to display Spike's love for Julia to really demonstrate his attachment here. But it's unless you do it properly, it's boring. You know that Spike can't die. You know that things are just going to keep replaying over and over again. It becomes repetitive. And that kind of repetitive narration detracts from the point that the story's trying to tell.
Well, let's break down how we get there and see how much we have to say about the detail work. The first time we see Spike, he is in his room, which is a setting that you've pointed out before as unique to the live action. And a drawer falls out all over the ground. There's an Alba City postcard, some 100 Wulong poker chips, a few spare bullets, playing cards, actual Wulongs, and a photo of him and Julia. It's a very Chekhov's gun type photo in that, you know, like you're going to see the scene where it was taken later on. They make it very clear that that's what they're going to do.
And this scene serves as a moment where we realize like Spike is thinking, you know what? This person's gone from my life. Why am I holding onto this photo? Let me throw it out. Way to go, Spike. Remove that attachment. Let's move on, please. So the scene moves on to Spike and Jet. And Spike is reluctant to pursue this Sai Baba, or who is known as Landa's now, even though Jet's like, come on, we have a lead. We can grab him. It'll be a good, you know, quick woo here. We've got some repairs to handle. So Jet's essentially talking Spike into going on this solo, even though the dude's killed 3,000 people. I want to give a shout out to Jet's real dad energy here when he said, quote, they found Bigfoot, smart guy. I saw it in a documentary. I adore that detail. And then we have Faye hot on the heels of that saying, I'll never pay for ammo again with this new Blitzer MJ railgun.
So when Spike and Jet are talking about the Landes Center, Spike brings up that there's apparently like a slogan or a catchphrase that Landes has, and it's free your mind and the rest will follow. This is a hit song by En Vogue that I remember hearing on the radio in my youth. And on one hand, big ups to the Netflix live action for doing what the original anime did and making some winks and nods to classic music titles that people would recognize. The problem for me is that John Cho delivers this with such a straight face that instead of coming across to me like a joke, like, hey, music stuff, funny, it seems like a real serious culty mantra. And it's sloppy for me. It's sloppy because they take a cute musical reference and take it kind of in a dark direction. But all of that cult stuff, I mean, Jamie, the last episode we did about Landes was so emotionally affecting. It was so grounded in real life cults and the tragedies that they've wreaked upon our world. That's all gone.
It's true. Like, Bebop had so many references and so much resource material to pull from. It really did make this a terrifying experience. And they chose to extract all that for the live action in order to serve this Julia Spike story that I felt was maybe a little heavy-handed.
In terms of Easter eggs, in this portion, the address to the Lande Center is 215 19th Street Northwest. I put that address into Google Maps and a couple of different cities, and I didn't find anything special, just people's houses. But hey, maybe it's someone's house. And then to the point about Faye's railgun, the package is from Electric Eliminators, and it's a Blitzer MJ railgun, which apparently was this sort of railgun technology in general and was a thing that for a while the US military was actually investing money in trying to do. And so that's kind of fun that everyone calling it a scam is almost a nod to like the military really tried it. It doesn't work.
So who else thinks it's a scam? Mel, our mechanic. She's totally not buying this. Faye's so excited to show it off. She can't find anything to place into the railgun's mechanism to try it out. But we also know Mel's got the hots for Faye. And can we go there? Yes, please.
Yes, we can. I want to point out that Jet uses they, them pronouns to address Mel at some point. And I'm not sure if that means like canonically those are Mel's pronouns or if it was Jet doing more of the like, I don't know sort of thing. But I want to throw that out there as a possibility for the character. And Mel and Iron Mink are in the opening of Cowboy Bebop. I love Mel. I love her relationship with Faye. And them being in the opening title, at least to me, says they were intended to maybe come back in season two. And as you all well know, at this point when we're recording, there will not be a season two. It's been canceled. And I'm so sad that we won't see more of Mel because this scene is hot. And I was also worried this was going to be queer baiting. Once we saw Mel and Faye flirting, I just had no faith in Netflix. And I was ready for Faye to just like reject her and then have them cut to black or something. Thank goodness this went in neither direction. Mel is not a creep, and this was not queer baiting.
Which I would say is the saving grace of this episode. I was ready to give this one a total two. But for reasons we'll go into later, this particular kind of subplot to the episode would be an 8 in my book.
Yeah, thank goodness this whole thing is here, because this Londa stuff is not doing it for me.
At first, when I saw Mel's character in the opening, I thought this was an homage to Elektra in some sense, but this episode puts that to bed. Maybe there would have been an Elektra in season two, but that ship has sailed. We also, in this episode, get a weird, bongy, dissonant remix of Tank, and I just want to say thanks. I hate it.
Like you said, we bounce back and forth between these plot lines very quickly, which I'm not sure does justice to Faye and Mel, or even the urgency of the Bebop potentially crashing and the crew's relationship with the ship and its needs. But we cut over to Spike, who is in the Landis Center, and we meet, I guess her name is Beatrice, this like automated, potentially AI woman on the screen. And I had to Google it. I think she does such a great job sounding like the voiceover from the anime that I wonder if they got the same person. They did not. This is a new actress, but wow, thumbs up for sounding so much like the original.
I remember when we first watched this episode and you were messaging me like, oh God, this set and oof, this really hurts, etc. And it occurred to me that the soundstage kind of does this episode justice, the exterior of the Londa Sender. I get this kind of 1960s Back to the Future vibes with this episode in particular. And Beatrice specifically reminds me of Janet from The Good Place. Overall, the interior of the Londa Sender reminds me of 2001, A Space Odyssey, The Prisoner, and maybe what Mr. Robot was going for in the final season. And so I think these were all really interesting visual themes to take from a psychedelic angle, but the execution was maybe a little lackluster.
I'm pretty confident I've had this argument multiple times with people now, but I'm not sure I've had it on mic. I totally concede that this look and feel makes sense for like a surreal Groundhog Day loop. Like what a horrible little box Spike is trapped in. I get it. It suits the scenes where he is under the influence of this AI and he's trapped. Where that falls flat on its face for me is that he explores this street in reality too. This is a real place. Jet drives up to it on his motorcycle. This weird, old-timey, tiny street is where the Londa Center is.
I'm just going to throw this out there. If anyone can help me answer this, what the hell is 4D printing? I have to know. So Spike follows Beatrice's directions and goes into the facility and sits in this ridiculous chair that's going to murder him. And we see like an eye, but it's not anime Spike's eye. We get the use of fisheye lenses to give this kind of vibe that this is a very surreal moment and that it's going to lead to some really weird mental gymnastics and challenges for Spike. But I just wasn't doing this. This was the first time in my first watch through where I said, can I please turn this off? I hated every single moment of it. And I wasn't sure why I felt this way at the time. But now in my second watch through, I realize how tropey this is. It's just mired in a lot of things that we've seen before in other film and shows. And it's just not adding anything new. It's not bringing anything new to the table.
I also try really hard to accept that these characters are new imaginings of my favorite characters and aren't always going to act exactly how I expect. But I just can't forgive Spike in this one, man. When he lies down in the chair and Beatrice is like, sure, you'll meet Londis, but first, a 90-minute exploration into your psyche. He does snap out of it eventually, but Spike has this moment where he's like, yeah, come on, Londis, expecting like he's going to be in this video or something. He's sure going to get him. And Spike's just being stupid in a way that I don't expect Spike to be stupid.
That's what I'm saying. He's kind of dull and boring. I don't understand this. What I do understand is Julia getting shot in the head repeatedly, sometimes by Vicious and sometimes by other characters, because that's the kind of level of violence the show has set multiple times. I still don't like it. I'm still not really into it at all. And then we're also getting this deliberate interpretation of Spike's dream, right? The one he needs to wake up from in the anime. But this is like literally the dream we're seeing. This is the thing that happens over and over again. This was kind of used as shorthand to tell us he's obsessed with her. And the anime, I feel, did it in such a more poignant way. It was always a constant through line without being so heavy-handed.
Yeah, I guess I just don't know why they thought I needed to be convinced. There are all these lines like nothing's changed between us. It's just lost time. I tried for 3 years to let you go, but I can't. They actually say that line more than once. He suggests like they could make a home together. And again, I have nothing but love for John Cho. I feel like his breathlessness and his vulnerability in his acting, he really is capturing that he has thought about Julia all the time. And that is supported by how often, especially in episode one, his flashbacks have been injected in his day-to-day life. But I believed him before this episode, you know? Like, I don't know why they thought I needed 45 minutes of reassurance that, like, this guy really likes her.
One more aspect to this plot that I'm really not digging is that the machine injects something into him that crawls to his forehead. And from a technical, like, VFX perspective, cool. Weird, though, that it can absorb through his skull and that they completely drop this plot line entirely.
Yes, thank you. Because I was raised on the X-Files, I think, I have a real phobia for, like, stuff under your skin. If you remember, the alien oil that sort of took the form in X-Files of worms almost crawling up the skin, and then they'd reach people's eyes and their eyes would black out. I have a true phobia about that sort of thing. And this episode told me something is under Spike's skin. It's in his brain, and we never took it out. It's always there, and it remains on my mind for the rest of the season.
I would appreciate this if maybe this was like a season two episode where Spike becomes the thing, and we get a whole the thing homage, but that's not going to happen. And I don't know why he would leave that loose end dangling so obviously.
Speaking of weird choices, this soundstage little town has a truly bizarre mix of vintage cars. And I'm talking like vintage by our perception, stuff that in 2021 we'd go, whoa, that's an old car. But also these like Elon Musk looking cyber cars, and then flying ships, stuff that looks like it's spacefaring. And I don't think it looks very intentional. I really like a world where they've conceived of this general concept that there needs to be land transport and there needs to be air transport. But the idea that it's not visually consistent in terms of era and is just sort of strewn wherever. We don't put airplanes on our streets just at random. I don't really get it. Maybe I'm being too nitpicky, Jamie.
That actually didn't bother me. In fact, some of the technical aspects of transitioning to the moment where Jet appears at the Londa Center from Spike's previous kind of VR loop, I actually really enjoyed that. I love the sky in the background. I love him rolling up on the motorcycle. And I was actually digging that weird filter you regularly complained about when we were watching screeners.
No, I hate the filter. I knew we were going to have like a tiff about this. So I will admit, that visual choice has improved since we got our screeners. We watched this before the rest of the world did by several weeks. And in my opinion, it's only my opinion, the first time we watched it, that filter was so, so strong. It was like neon and amateurish looking. It looked like someone just clicked one thing and MS Paint was like, that's it. That's Cowboy Bebop. And I was so mad. But I think since then, and they told us this might happen, they actually put this in our letter, I think they did some more work on it. It's a lot more subtle, especially in how it ramps up over time. The first time Spike breaks out, we're really supposed to not know yet that he's in a loop. We're supposed to believe that maybe he's back in real life. And they kept the filter at kind of a minimum to keep the illusion up for a while. Still pretty weird looking though, Jamie. It's still pretty weird looking and glowy and colorful, but I know you like it.
I'm really into it because it reminds me of like that sheen on soap bubbles. Like you're looking through the world in rainbow colored glasses. And that's a good euphemism for what Spike is going through right now in his VR experience. But I'm with you. The first pass through when we watched it did look a little bit more rough. I know exactly the filter in Photoshop that I would have used to recreate that texture.
Yeah, and I can even remember the way I tried to convince myself to like it because it reminded me so much of, you know, early MS Paint or early Photoshop. I was like, ah, this is kind of nostalgic. This kind of reminds me of the era when the anime was made because if I were effing around on the computer in that era, this is what I would do. But I really think that was me just like bending over backwards to not hate this. And there's a similar thing that comes up immediately after where I had a similar reaction, which is the TV tower. That big TV tower comes up out of the floor and you do that sort of Leonardo DiCaprio meme where he's pointing like, look, a thing I recognize. but I don't know why it is a TV tower. Why is it a pile of vintage TVs other than to make us anime fans go, ooh?
I mean, from a film perspective, it's an interesting challenge. It adds that texture. It's very 1960s. Like, I get it. But I also feel like, say, the film The Matrix that I just rewatched that had like a million times more budget just did this better job at simulation, at like these themes of mind and body, at the idea that you're dealing with, you know, rogue AI that is trying to end humanity. In this case, it doesn't want to end Spike necessarily. It just wants his consciousness, like more buddies to hang out with. And I don't know why televisions represent the physical manifestation of this AI in particular.
One choice that I can tell the production crew made that maybe didn't get its flowers like it should have was that I really do think they thought through how this process works, how the experience works for the person stuck in the dream, how it extracts their consciousness. And I discovered that by doing my favorite thing, which is pausing the footage. Every time Spike goes through this loop and he tries something a little different with Julia, like just get her out of the scene, get her on the motorcycle, take her somewhere else, say something different. There are these lightning fast flashes of the TVs and what's coming onto the TVs. And if you look, there's a very cool, like, algorithmic thing happening where the script of what the people are saying comes up onto the screen. And then the tech runs like a probability on if we make Julia reply to question X in way Y, there is this percentage of success on convincing Spike. Like, you can see the calculation the computer is doing to come up with verbal responses that will manipulate Spike in the way that it wants. I wish they showed us more of that. It's so cool that this crew thought about what this AI is doing and how it thinks. But then in the editing room, they just went with like spooky flashes of TV and data and letters and all of that thought work. It's not there unless you pause.
I don't know about you, Lauren, but when we got our introduction to the man who built this AI system, I instantly was like, oh, they're going to tell us. Like, this is a tell us moment because they either couldn't fit it in visually or somehow it was just easier to explain it in this way. And I felt this was a very dull solution to what was normally, you know, a lot of investigation work on Jet's behalf. This is just someone here to tell us exactly what's happening to Spike and how to save the day.
Yeah, funnily enough, my first thought about this guy was that he looked like John Goodman in The Big Lebowski.
I thought he looked like the one guy from Jurassic Park, the old crazy dude who built the dinosaur islands.
Oh, interesting. But you're actually right. He knows exactly what's going on, how to explain it. And it's just strange to me that Jet believes him. Like, how did this guy come to have all this information? What good does it do for the AI? It's all stuff that, like, if a man just walked into a building and I'd never met him before and he started telling me these things, I'd be very sus. A couple more Easter eggs that I couldn't find, just big Easter egg failures on my part. The number that comes up on the screen that, like, is Spike's case number or something in terms of this, how this AI catalogs him. It's 23893, maybe someone's zip code. I'd love to know why these numbers were chosen or if they were random. And Spike's motorcycle helmet has a really intricate and cool looking flag on it. And I have to imagine it's something in world that was thought out. And so if anyone who worked on the show wants to tell us what that flag is, I'd be stoked to hear it.
So following the action chronologically, we get a scene with Mel and Faye on the floor of the engine room. They've just hooked up. It was hot and sexy, we can presume. And we're getting this very chill version, a piano version of poor Faye lip cream, which I thought was just really tugging on my heartstrings. What a great take here. Daniela Pineda really sells the experience of Faye's amnesia here and how she's connecting with Mel. And it was through my second watch through that I realized that Mel served as the welcome portrayal of this warmth and openness that we get through Mepha and Stella's stories in the anime. Otherwise, we don't have that kind of secondary person around to tell people that, no, you're a good soul. You have the warmth. I believe in you. Here's a loving and entrusting experience. And that's really what saved this episode for me.
Mel is such a great example of why people should watch this show more than once and why I'm really disappointed that the show got canceled. Given that Bebop was only on Netflix for, what, 3 weeks and they pulled the plug, I don't think everyone even got a chance to revisit this and develop deeper, more nuanced opinions. Obviously, the first time I watched this episode, it was all about the sex, like the shock and awe that I felt that they actually, thank goodness, allowed two women to have a sexual relationship. I was like, oh, thank goodness. Amazing. And that's all I saw because I was just processing that it even occurred. But you're absolutely right. There's this whole intimate scene between these two characters with Faye talking about, imagine touching a hot kettle or skinning your knee and you're a grown-up and it's the first time you're experiencing these things. It's really well acted and they're crying together. These women are opening up in such an important way for Faye's character arc, and it's not given the due diligence it deserves, given that this episode is so much about Spike and Julia, and also Jet's here. It just deserved the room to breathe. But I watch this again, and I feel like Mel is a good person. She's not just the funny mechanic hooking up with Faye for laughs. This could be someone in Faye's life who really helps her discover who she is. In fact, Mel tells her, like, I'd love to be with you again. I'd love to see you again. But it's important that you figure out who you are. If anything in season one left me wanting more, it was this. A couple more points about Mel that are not necessarily my original opinions, just stuff I've seen on the internet that I agree with. I really think this conversation between them about Faye experiencing things for the first time justifies why her personality might be a little bit more juvenile or a little bit more like cussing and tomboyish, because she is. She tells us here that in a way, she's still psychologically a child. She's got a lot to work on and grow through. There's also another Cowboy Bebop podcast I discovered called The Real Folk Dudes, and they suggested that maybe Faye's whole sexy scammer using her feminine wiles as a weapon personality could come later in her timeline using Mel as an inspiration. And I thought that was such a cool take.
I also want to give a shout out to the scene because the writers explicitly gave Faye this time and trust to let her divulge her entire story. Whereas in the anime, she's telling Ayn and Spike overhears it, right? This wasn't really a consensual way to explain her story. And then Whitney shows up and it kind of all is forced out of her. So for the writers to make the active choice to say, no, we want Faye to tell her story in a loving and trusting environment, props on them. I really enjoyed this experience. I wish we got more of it. And it was actually serving that itch I had where we sit with our characters a little longer, right? Where we get this moment of time passing and people experiencing their emotions in an internalized way. And that's what's Bebop to me.
It's so bizarre that we get such a shining example of, as you say, spending time with our characters and just letting them feel their feelings in the very same episode that sticks us in this loop and makes us watch it over and over. Julia and Spike are doing this thing that I compared it to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but that's not right because Eternal Sunshine is one of my favorite movies ever, and this is not a favorite and is never going to be. I do want to point out Julia's outfit. Her kind of snakeskin vest, I think, looks really awesome. I think her hair looks better in this episode than in most. And she's got a belt that is, I think, directly inspired by the belt she wears with her cat suit in the anime and in several pieces of art. They also go to a hotel room and the door on the room is 321, which I can only imagine is a 321 Let's Jam reference. Oh boy.
Spike's convinced that if they reach out to Jet and he gets Julia aboard the Bebop, that they can run away together and everything will be great, which I think says a lot to Spike's dependency on Jet overall in their partnership. I don't think anime Spike would ever want to involve Jet or Faye in anything involving Julia. And this kind of threw me for a loop.
I support that opinion because we see in The Real Folk Blues in the anime that once Spike has Julia with him, when he says they're running away together, he never means back to the Bebop. Until Julia is actually dead, I don't think he ever intended to see Jet or Faye ever again. You're right.
I also refuse to believe that anime Jet would kill Spike if he knew about Spike's syndicate past. Like, that's just not a given in the show, and it's weird that the live action makes such a point over it. In this scene, we also believe our quote-unquote fearless believes that Julia chose Vicious, and I don't think that's true of the anime either.
I definitely think it's true here, though. We see some scenes later on of them going on dates and having a relationship. So while it's still possible Julia has Spike in her heart, she did, yeah, definitely marry the guy in this one. She had more agency over picking Vicious.
I almost felt that Julia was so deep into it that she had to marry him.
It's such a weird timeline, isn't it? Like, they're established as this married couple and like their whole relationship is decided and Spike needs to wrestle with the idea of letting her go because she's gone. And that's all very cool. And it's just muddled up by the fact that it was all only 3 years ago. I think the fact that we're litigating this shows that it's a problem.
You know what else is a problem?
What?
Getting to Earth in 11 minutes. Fuck that. I'm so angry.
Yeah, the tension gets really high here. Jet knows that he needs to go to the servers on Earth and manually do something to physically wrench Spike out of this world that he's in. At the same time, the AI has really ramped up its efforts to convince Spike to give up and let Julia go because that's sort of its food. That's how it really gets in and takes his consciousness away. And so Julia starts making what, in hindsight, I think are actually some good points. Julia's saying, "You said you could keep me safe, but you couldn't have." She goes so far as to say, "You killed me," which of course is more in the world of this dream than anything. But I wish this episode went a little bit further into confronting how Spike's obsession maybe does for real harm his grip on reality. I think there's a lot of people in this show saying, if only I got what I wanted, I can keep us safe and we could get out of here and it would be okay. And they're wrong. This episode goes in a direction where I think we're supposed to believe that Spike's right. Spike is right. His love for Julia is true. He's doing a good thing. But I don't know about all that evil dream Julia saying, you might not have your hands on the wheel entirely. She's got some points.
You're making a point that I think I kind of agree with partially, but I don't think anime Spike for a second would believe that Julia hates him or is angry with him or believes that he's a psychopath. We get the assumption that Julia is somehow involved in syndicate business in both cases, but I don't know. It seems so wild to have Spike in either case believe his love for Julia is going to save him and that they're going to run away and they're going to have this perfect future together. But then for him to be so gutted by the fact that live action Julia is so fucking mean to him. It was just a very weird take for this episode to go in.
I think part of this episode's many problems is the order in which we are given information. Julia says, my husband may do bad things, but you're the psychopath. And she references something that happens at the Blue Crow. She's like, you murdered all of them, including that girl. Clearly, we're supposed to see this as an active trauma, a real regret that Spike still feels and really affects him. But we don't know what that is. We haven't seen that scene. And so it's very hard for us to put ourselves in Spike's shoes and be like, whoa, that one cut deep.
We get a little bit of foreshadowing about what happened to Earth in the shootout that's kind of like this old Western going on Spike's path to the Bebop in the VR loop specifically. There's a memorial statue that says, in memory of the lives lost in the Earth's astral gate accident, which has been referred to before in other episodes, but they're really pressing it hard here because guess what? We're going to Earth. We get to see it.
It's just sure convenient that even though this dream sequence doesn't happen on Earth, they just coincidentally are having a gunfight on a street where there is a memorial to the giant plot point of the gate accident. Who would have thought? Wow, what a coincidence.
I will say that I love how vibrant the shootout gets. We see all of these very saturated colors, a lot of action. It feels alive. And it's clear they know how beautiful it is because they're really ramping it up for this VR setting. But then we go back to the average muted tones of the series once we're back in quote reality.
As the Bebop, having gotten to Earth in 11 minutes, careens toward the planet, Jet's choices really come to bear fruit, like right away. He went and he got this secondhand part that Mel told him not to get. And already one of the engines of the ship is just in danger of blowing off. Good job, Jet.
I'm so glad that this episode involved space travel at all. I love the CG of Earth. I love the acting and convincing of the Bebop getting tossed around and all these things on fire. It reminded me a lot of like Kaylee and Firefly, which gave me those happy vibes. But I was so distracted by the Spike and Julia VR loop that I think I lost all the emotional impact I was pining for from this specific scene. It really was a shame that all these things layered in such a way that felt very disjointed.
Yeah, as the Bebop is entering the atmosphere and parts are literally flying off in flames, I thought that looked really good. There's been a lot of questions about this show's budget and the CGI happening around it. And man, I was convinced by this crash. I wish we did more of this. I also really like that Faye got to be the one to solve the problem. Even though Mel is sort of the expert mechanic, Faye knows the Bebop well enough. She knows her way around and suggests the sprinkler system. And that even adds another layer to like, Faye's an asset to the Bebop. Faye and Mel have a great relationship. This part of the episode is so much better than the one they stick us with for the majority of the time.
Woof. So we finally get to where Londis's servers are housed and they're stored behind bulletproof glass and the team just shoots at them, not worried about any ricochet or anything. Okay, cool. But this is where the railgun pulls through. Faye pulls it out. She finds something to put into the chamber and the joke is complete. She saved the day.
This scene takes place in a place called Area 827, which I guess is sort of an Area 51 joke. And there is a song, a sort of mournful whistling that I swear sounds like one of the songs from Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, like maybe the Overworld song. And I only bring this up because like one or two episodes ago, I was swearing that a new Yoko Kanno track sounded like Donkey Kong. So within like three episodes, the new Yoko Kanno stuff to me has taken inspiration from both Donkey Kong and Legend of Zelda. Is it a coincidence? I feel like I'm going crazy over here.
Lauren, you're a product of the 90s.
Yoko Kanno, do you like Nintendo? Call me. I will play Nintendo with you anytime.
So we wrap up this story on the Bebop. We're in the vicinity of where I presume Mel lives, which is also a suburbs and I hate it. Spike is asleep on the couch while Jet is cooking, and that feels overly familiar. I absolutely adore this little scene between them. Jet tells us that Londis is the live observing neural department emulation system that he just destroyed to save Spike's ass. At this moment, it really solidified that MPU is kind of the brainchild of Londis, like this weird mashup of it. Then we get into some more things about Spike constantly lying to Jet. Like he tells him we didn't learn anything in his VR loop. Nothing happened. I forgot. And that reminded me that Spike in this version is just an asshole and I hate it. Don't like it. I'm big pouts right now.
Yeah, in the defense of this script, I'm not sure Anime Spike necessarily would have opened up his heart to be like, I was trapped in a terrible loop and had to analyze the actions of my life and my love for this woman. Like, I don't think he would have. But because it's one example of many, many lies he tells and many, many times he's a jerk to Jet, yeah, it does still contribute to that overall discomfort I have. It's also weird how that plotline resolves, and maybe you got something different out of this, but when Spike goes back to be by himself and reflect on the end of that loop, he imagines a scenario where he doesn't, in fact, let Julia go, and he's like, but not without you, and takes her by the hand and runs. And I really didn't understand what they were trying to tell us here. Were they trying to tell us the AI was, in fact, never going to fully get him because he was still fighting? Is this what he wished he had done now that he was out? I didn't get the point here, and maybe it just went over my head.
I read that we didn't see the scene during the final loop, and they chose to save this last little bit before Spike wakes up for revealing it at this time. And I think the message is that Spike's love is so enduring and so passionate that, of course, this AI had no chance of fully getting him. But it did. Ultimately, it did. Before he even ended up in the VR loop, he was ready to let go of Julia altogether. And now this newfound spark has reinitiated his obsession. And here we are back at square one.
Thankfully, a plot that does resolve in a way I really enjoy is Faye and Mel. Faye gives Mel the railgun in a sort of like an excuse to see you again kind of move. And Mel has this really precious line where she takes the gun, but she's not really talking about the gun. She says, she's yours whenever you want her back. And she's clearly talking about herself. She would see Faye again if given the consent. And that gives me goosebumps right now, even revisiting it out loud. I ship it.
I also thought Mel's departure down the hallway was a really great shot, and I want to stay on this bebop forever.
Yeah, I've been getting really irritated, especially since the cancellation, the way the trolls have sort of been reveling in their victory of getting this show put down. God, it's obnoxious anyway, but so many of the comparisons for like why the anime is good and why this is bad are cherry picked and bad faith. Faye is an example where this came up really recently. I saw someone do this like side by side meme of anime Faye sitting and reflecting on solitude and saying something really deep about being by herself and protecting herself. And then they show Daniela Pineda going, welcome to the ouch, motherfuckers. And of course, if you compare those two moments, you're going to come out with a bad taste in your mouth. But if you compare the anime with this moment, I think this is the exact same Faye. This Faye who, in quiet moments, you can just see the sorrow and the confusion hanging over her. And you just really feel for her. This is the most correctly Bebop moment, I think, maybe in the entire Netflix for me, is just Faye sitting by herself, knowing she has to make it through another day.
And this is where the episode can end, but it doesn't. We get a really brief Vicious flashback, and I gotta say, I hate this Vicious. I hate this episode, and why is it like this? We also get Mr. Saxophone's song here, which really threw me for a loop tonally.
Yeah, I saw on social media Mason Alexander Park actually telling Elena Satine, I wish I got to play Goodnight Julia for you on sax. And it makes me wonder if this was meant to be literal foreshadowing for that happening in the future.
Aw, damn it.
Yeah, it's weird that what I think is my least favorite episode still makes me feel so remorseful that we're not going to get a second shot.
Yeah, I think through our adventures with talking to people who worked on the Netflix show and combing through this material so vigilantly and interacting with the fan community, I am starting to feel little pangs of regret that our show is ending soon or winding down in the near future. So Not to be a downer, but there are only so many Cowboy Bebop episodes to discuss. And I can't wait for, as you say, our haunted corpses to rest.
This one ends with, are you living in the real world? And at the time, I thought it was pretty gratuitous that they went with that in this moment. But it hits different now. It sure does. Because here in the real world, the number one motivator is money. And we live in late stage capitalism and our show is canceled. We are living in the real world and it's disappointing.
Well, I'm so excited today because not only did we get to talk about how much of a badass Mel is as a character, but we actually got to speak with Jade Harlow herself about playing Mel and what she experienced on set.
Here's that interview. All right, all you bounty hunters in the star system, we are so excited to welcome one of our favorite characters from the Netflix Cowboy Bebop, the actor behind Mel this episode. Please welcome Jade Harlow.
Hello.
Hey.
Jade, thank you so much for being here. We are really honored. It's fantastic to talk to one of the actors from the show.
I'm thrilled to be here. So thank you so much for having me.
We'll just cut right to it, if that's okay. We read in other interviews with you that acting is just all you've ever wanted to do. But when specifically did that spark for you? What makes you so passionate about doing this?
I wanted to do it since I was a kid because I felt like it was more comfortable to pretend to be anything other than me. So that's what the attraction was. And then there was a moment in my like gothic youth where I thought, well, maybe it would be really cool to be a homicide detective. But then I started working as an actor before I could nourish that garden.
I love that you had a goth phase. Do you still get to live some of that out today?
Sometimes. It's really hard to let go of the clothes, you know? Like, because you felt sexy and cool and all of this in that stuff. And then you get to be, you know, of a certain age where it's just like not such a good look anymore.
So speaking of sexy and cool, we know your career includes appearances on soap operas where characters often have to be portrayed that way. Lauren was apparently a big fan of Days of Our Lives, since we had to give a shout out there. And we've previously compared Cowboy Bebop to a soap opera or a telenovela in earlier episodes. So how do your experiences in soap operas compare to filming Cowboy Bebop?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like all shows are at their core a soap opera. You know, you look at Game of Thrones. What is it? It's family dynamics with drama happening in between. There's lust and sex and intrigue and lies and betrayal. Same thing in a show like Succession, same thing in a show like Bebop. So I think anytime you're dealing with close familial dynamics within a show, you can see the similarities between something at its core like a soap opera and anything that, you know, is like a familial betrayal, lust, sex, violence kind of situation.
And they definitely injected a lot of extra sex and a lot of extra violence for this live action, that's for sure. We also noticed that you won some daytime Emmys for your role on The Bay. Congratulations on that. That is a streaming show, I believe, as is some of your other work. How has this era of digital streaming and binge watching affected your career?
You know, it's interesting. You really have to fight for the audience's attention. There's more room to have pretty much any content created because you don't necessarily need to rely on the same four networks to pick up your pilot, give you the money to make the show. People are making shows in a million different ways. And then they're being shot initially as web series, which was what The Bay was before getting picked up by Amazon, which was like, what? Why? Oh, great. Great. Okay. Also at the same time, it definitely changes the financial dynamics for everybody working in entertainment because, you know, you used to get paid residuals. So a show would air on a network at a certain time and then it would sell to other countries or it would, you know, rerun or get syndication and you'd get a little check. And if you do multiple episodes, you'd get eventually, you know, on your third or fourth round, you get these weird little checks for like 22 cents. but all of those little checks added up. And now with streamers who are still working under contracts of new media, as if they don't understand how they make profit. It's challenging. And I think it's worth taking a look at now that Netflix knows what it is and how they make profit, and Amazon knows what they are and how they make profit, and Hulu and so on. It's time to take a look at how the artists get paid in terms of viewership and, you know, international access.
That is such an interesting answer and not what I expected. But I tell you what, we are not fans of like billionaires and Jeff Bezos in this house. And more money going to artists is so necessary and so important. I'm so glad you're spreading that message.
So we have to know, we ask everyone who joins our show from the Netflix live action, if you were a fan of the anime before you heard of this opportunity, and if you weren't, are you now?
I was a huge fan of the anime. I can't say that here with you guys because you guys have me beat in spades. You know, I was 16 when the anime came out. I remember Adult Swim and the launch of Adult Swim. And I remember one of my very first crush was on the, when Adult Swim came out, it was Cowboy Bebop and Aeon Flux.
Yeah.
Hey girl, like for real. with that anime. That was my introduction to anime were those two shows. And yeah, I was a fan of like being able to bend genres and bend the rules, which is something that, you know, we couldn't do because up until that point, anime hadn't made it mainstream.
I'm so excited to learn that you have this history with this show, because I think the addition of Mel really adds a new layer to what the anime had. I would love to see an anime version of Mel. So we'll get into that shortly, but
she's going to be hotter with a smaller waist and bigger boobs. For sure. I think there's a lot of fans of Bebop. I think one of the questions definitely in the casting process was, you know, are you familiar with Bebop? Were you a fan of the anime? And I think it was important to the people making the show that the people who were coming to play in this playground respected and admired what existed before.
So what was that audition like? And what were you told about Mel, given that she wasn't a part of the original?
Nothing. I was told nothing. And when I got the sides, I was like, are we sure Mel is a lady? Are we sure this is not a dude? Because like sometimes when it's open casting, you don't even know what the gender of the role is, what they're thinking. So I knew nothing going in except for Mel had an attraction to Faye. Also, I felt like this was not their first rodeo in having to negotiate like buying the new part with Jet, who is notoriously cheap, and the Bebop is forever broken in some stage, which is part of the charm of the Bebop.
So Mel is a hotly discussed character because she is an original creation. Like I said, I absolutely adore her. So did you get the opportunity to creatively influence how Mel shaped out in the end? Was that kind of part of the job, or did you have more guidelines into how you portrayed her?
You know, it's funny. There were definitely guidelines, but also it was a really collaborative environment. In the casting process, in the callback process, and working with the producers and the director and the cast, it felt like the most collaborative environment I had ever had the honor to play in. So yeah, there was some input, like the tattoos were a big input for me. I had specific tattoos that I had hoped they would let Mel have, and they were open to it. And the other thing is, you know, they're open to like collaborating the look of the character. They don't want to make any actor feel uncomfortable, not only in the wardrobe, but like in the hair of it all. And they were like, do you want to be wigged? And I was like, no, don't want a wig, cut my hair, shave the head, whatever you want to do. And they were definitely like, all right, well, we're not going to go too far with it, but if you're going to let us cut all your hair off, we'll just cut all your hair off. And that really helped me sort of like lean into a new version of myself in a way.
What was it like to film some of these scenes, specifically the Bebop crashing? There's a lot of like slamming yourself around this set and like trying to fix the mechanisms. A, what was that like? But also, how much of that was real versus CGI or things added in post?
Well, it's interesting. There was a lot cut from the episode. So like they brought me in early and they like trained me on how to use, it wasn't a soldering iron. I don't know what it was. I was basically lasering metal with fire and it was creating a spark throwing effect that they really wanted in like the fixing of the Bebop. So, you know, they bring you in or bring me in, they bring all of us in and they train you how to work with this equipment that, you know, is a fire hazard and a danger. And when they train you, they've got you as covered as you can be. But I know the wardrobe at this point is going to be a tank top. So I'm sort of like, really, we're wearing mittens. Okay. So it was all shot practically. Even the things that, you know, felt a little like, uh-oh, are we going to get hurt here? That didn't make it in, were all shot practically. And the actors that I had a chance to work with were down with, you know, the more stunts, the better. Like, let's really, like, if we get hurt, we're going to be fine. It's not like we're, you know, going to die doing this. When we get bruised up or whatever, it's chill.
So if we start diving into the meat of the episode, Binary Two-Step is really complex. It's exploring themes about Spike Spiegel's inner mind, and the anime episode it's based on is all about cults and letting go of the past. Why do you think Mel was placed in this episode particularly?
I think, you know, by the time we get to episode 6, there's a lot we didn't know about Faye. And there's a lot of us seeing how Faye copes with trying to gauge her comfortability with being herself around people. So those walls are up and she, you know, uses humor as a deflection, you know, getting to know her at any depth. And I think that Mel was brought in as someone who wouldn't be there on an everyday basis and was not a physical threat to her. Somebody who just really didn't want anything from her except for like, kind of dig you and I'm feeling this if you're feeling this. And I think Mel became the safest place Faye had experienced since coming out of cryosleep. And I think that's why Mel was brought in.
Oh, geez. I heard you say in there, someone who's not around all the time, which to me heavily implies she could come back, which is what we wanted. This is the first interview we're doing since the cancellation, and we're just so sorry.
Thanks. Yeah, me too. I mean, I know it affects you guys and your podcast, you know, so condolences back at you.
So what do you, other than your tattoos, have in common with Mel, and how are you two different?
I certainly couldn't put together a spaceship. So we'll start with that. I could change the battery in my car and change a tire, but that's the extent of my mechanic abilities. Also where we're similar, you know, I've had relationships with women. That is not a foreign concept to me. Being different, I think Mel is a much overtly sexually confident person, which I would love to be. I would love to be that person who, like, I'm confident in the flirt and I'm just going to like, hey, I'm into you. Let me just put it out there. You know, when it comes to like admitting I like somebody or I'm attracted to somebody, I've totally failed to do that. And when I do it, when I have done it, it's been like, oh, that's cute. So it's like, oh, but I'm serious. Oh no. It's fine.
So let's talk about Mel's relationship with Faye. This doesn't necessarily have to be canon. This is more us just asking you, in what depth do you think Mel is interested in Faye? Do you think it was sort of a one-time thing? It was just a moment of attraction? Or in your heart, was Mel interested in maybe more or coming back?
I think that, I think it's not easy for Mel. I feel like Mel is kind of an isolated person. You know, she's a female doing a job that is largely a male environment. So she's, you know, made connections, but they've been platonic or they've been inappropriate in her mind. And to have, you know, someone that she's genuinely attracted to, and then you have that reciprocated enough to get into bed together. And then as you get to know them beyond having slept with them, you realize like, this is a really good person. Like, I wish we had met in different circumstances so it wouldn't have had to go so fast. Like, I think Mel would have liked to have properly courted Faye, but I don't know that Faye, in her development point, would have been ready to be courted by anyone, which is why I think sex is more comfortable to jump in first before the getting to know you process. But I think Mel will always see Faye as like, God, I wonder what would have happened.
I'm sure this is going to come up in the greater part of our episode when you're not here, but I so appreciate that you brought up Faye's readiness, because Faye went through a trauma that is still active in her life and being processed. And I'm just, from a mental health perspective, glad to know that you as an actor had that in mind. Like, that is part of the relationship between these two people.
Yeah, I think that in knowing what I knew about the character of Faye, but which Mel didn't know. But when you meet somebody who's so like, you can sense their walls are up. You can sense that everything is a deflection or humor. It's like something has happened to make them protective. And I think what I as a human would like to do, and I think what Mel was aiming to do, is like, listen, man, this is a safe space. Like, I'm attracted to you. If you're attracted to me, great. And if not, no sweat, I'm not going to make it weird. Just, you know, kind of moving on. But I think if Faye had kept her walls up and not been open enough to flirt back and to lean in, Mel would have just like been like, you know, you're cute, I'm out of here.
So we're touching a bit on this idea of compassion and like a safe person to confide in. And we know that Anime Faye's backstory is really shown via flashback, and Spike is listening in on her. She's revealing everything to Ayn, and she's forced to confront her past trauma by the con man who is her current bounty. I'm so grateful that they allowed live action Faye to have a more compassionate reveal. So do you personally have any takes on this alteration in her story?
I think that you can approach anime with a certain level of inhumanity and a certain level of, you know, insensitivity, because you know that these characters are not real people, you know? So if someone makes a shitty comment or behaves in an abusive way, I mean, when you look at how Gren in the anime became Gren and that character's, you know, backstory, there's a lot of things that in real life or in a live action feel irresponsible to do to an audience when you're displaying these characters as human beings, as opposed to, you know, works of art that are drawn and animated. I liked that they were more sensitive, not just with revealing Faye's past trauma and backstory, but also the way they had, you know, opened up about Jet, which, you know, we didn't ever see him as a family man, but it's nice to know like where the heart of someone with so much heart, where that heart got broken and where that heart hopes to be redeemed. And I think that those are things that, you know, in an anime, you maybe you have less interest in knowing that way, because you can't really read the eyes and you can't really feel the heartbeat and the tension necessarily, because they're animated.
You mentioned Gren's story, and we know the anime version of Gren could be damaging if presented the same way in 2021. So just kind of overall, what are your thoughts about Mel and some of the other changes made to this show in terms of representation?
You know, it's funny, like the 16-year-old me, when I was watching Cowboy Bebop and I see this, you know, futuristic world that felt like, yeah, I could see how that would happen in like the horrific story that is Gren's story. And you know, that was 20 some odd years ago. And I think we as a people and our inherent want for the majority to acknowledge and embrace diversity within ourselves and within our friends and loved ones and neighbors and culture, that's evolved in leaps and bounds. So in the new version of Bebop, in the live action version of Bebop, it feels in terms of diversity more now than next. Like, it's not even a question. In the very near future, if not when you talk to Zoomers, like when I talk to like my nephews who, you know, are one's 15, like they don't care what somebody's gender identity is. They don't care what their sexuality is. Everything is fluid. Everything's accepted. It's sort of like a non-topic. I think that that is important. I think it's important if you need to identify under the banner of a label and it gives you comfort and it makes you feel part of a community, that's important that it be honored within yourself and within the community. But if giving yourself a label makes you feel limited in your self-evolution, then it becomes less necessary, I think. And I think in the world that Bebop created in terms of sexuality and sexual identity and gender identity, it really is a world where the person is accepted for the quality of the character, quality of who they are in the moment, as opposed to seeing them as like, oh, that person is this label or that label.
That's really powerful stuff. Thank you for sharing. So flipping back to the anime, as someone who watched it recently, I realize how little sex there is overall. There's some implied moments, but I'm pretty certain no one's getting any on the Bebop. And the live action had this opportunity to present this new situation and scenario to us. I personally thought that was one of the best parts of this episode, if not the whole show, particularly your chemistry with Daniela Pineda. And so we wanted to know, what goes into preparing a romantic scene and how do you get comfortable?
Yo, it's changed, man. It has changed, dude. So I have been in the business, like professionally, since 1999. So I've shot all kinds of love scenes with you name it, under whatever circumstance. And is it awkward? Can we cuss? Fuck yeah, it's awkward. It is so awkward. But typically, you know, you talk to your partner in the scene and you talk to the director and what is the aim of the affections being shared? And you can glean that, you know, if you're a smart actor from the script, like this is a one night stand or this is like, you know, a pity fuck or this is whatever it is, you know, the physicality comes in accordingly. Nowadays, and this is where I'm going to be an asshole. Nowadays, they have these things called intimacy coordinators, right? You have a stunt coordinator, teaches you how to do stuff. You have an intimacy coordinator. And I fully understand the purpose as explained as to having one on set. As a female who's been in the business since I was a minor and have had horrible things happen to me, you know, in casting offices and on set and name it. And it just felt part of the norm of being a female in this business. When I was younger, would I like to have had a safe person that I could go to and say, this feels sideways and I'm too shy to speak up about it. And could you advocate for me because I'm uncomfortable? That would have been amazing. But nowadays, you know, working with somebody who, with Daniela, she's been around, she's worked professionally forever. And so have I, and so is John, and so is everybody on the show. It becomes an interesting dynamic to figure out how to, you know, you come to the table respectful, you understand the intentions of the scene. There was a whole sex scene shot with Daniela that was edited out of the show. That was, yeah, oh yeah, girls. It was a whole thing. And there was like with nudity in the nine. Yeah, but it was shot as a comedic beat. It was shot as like the moment is interrupted by Jet, who's like, you know, is the mechanic done servicing her yet? And she takes the call and it hasn't happened yet, but it's happening. And so it was meant as a comedic beat and it ended up not making the show. But, you know, in working with Daniela in that moment, we both knew what the scene was. We both had worked in this capacity, maybe not necessarily shot a love scene with a woman before, which is oddly way more comfortable because I know what would make me uncomfortable and I can only assume that would make her uncomfortable. But there's definitely conversations, whether it's a love scene with a woman or with a man or who, whatever, where it's just like, this is how I was thinking of approaching it. What are you comfortable with? Some actors, I've had actors, I'm thrilled I'm not working with them anymore, who didn't like even the smallest affections, like comforting someone during a grief scene, didn't want to be held, didn't want to be, you know, any of it. So she was great. She was very generous, super professional. We were both very, very comfortable with one another and how to do the scene. The only thing that made us uncomfortable was having to deal with the intimacy coordinator who really wanted to choreograph every little head movement and name it, which, you know, became its own sidebar conversation with the actors.
I am shocked that that was all shot. And as much as I wish we could have, not literally, I just mean story-wise, seen more of you, I'm glad that it was cut, I think, because the way it is now, and Jamie, you can tell me if you agree or not, I don't think the sexual part is played like a joke. I think the joke is that Jet sort of pops in at the end and you're like, phew, glad he wasn't here earlier. But their moment right now seems very sincere.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when the producers were going over, I can only assume, you know, I'm not them, but I can assume that when they went through the episode that they had the comedic beats that they already were aiming for in terms of breaking the tension in the episode as a whole. And that once they had the work strung together, they were like, you know what? It's not necessary.
So given that Mel's time on the Bebop was very specific in a very specific place, did you get to meet any of the rest of the cast who weren't a part of your scenes? Or was that call time very sort of boxed in?
This was a super extraordinary experience being in New Zealand with a lot of Americans during COVID, during Thanksgiving. So I've met pretty much everyone. And, you know, you develop a bond being in a new place. You know, different people have different schedules and off times. And so, you know, definitely I've met almost pretty much every guest star on the show who happened to be in the country at the same time when there was a Thanksgiving potluck hosted in New Zealand, which doesn't celebrate Thanksgiving.
That warms my heart.
Was there like traditional American Thanksgiving food or was it other food?
It's funny. So in New Zealand, it's summer. So, but we, you know, it's Thanksgiving to the Americans. And so we traditionally made, you know, like the stuffing and I did a ham and, you know, everybody brought different things. People who were working that day popped off at KFC and brought like mashed potatoes and chicken and like, you know, desserts and you name it. Yeah. And there was a lot of liquor, which was a lot of fun. And yeah, everybody was just super chill. Everybody was a real person. You know, nobody, there was no ego. There was no separation in terms of I am this number on the call sheet. I'm going to behave a certain way. And you know, everybody was just a good, chill human being going through a shared experience.
Oh man, it really shows through in the premiere photos, I think. Everyone's having a great time and I'm glad we got to see as, you know, fans of the show and just really wondering what is behind the scenes going on. That charisma coming through in those photos too, so.
It was so great to see everybody. It was weird to see everybody outside of our bubble of New Zealand, you know? It's like, oh my God, you're here. but, you know, there was definitely more of this like summer camp closeness on this set with everybody who shared the experience of being a part of the show. And I worked with John on an entirely separate project while I was in New Zealand when Bebop wrapped. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
So that was cool.
So just for fun, Jamie and I are reading the Cowboy Bebop book right now because our life as Cowboy Bebop, we're extremely haunted by it. But we saw that you're a very avid reader. Is there anything you're reading right now?
Oh my God. So I'm obsessed with this series of books. Let me just preface this by saying I'm not a romance book person. I'm allergic to rom-coms. I'm allergic to all of it. But Nora Roberts writes under a different pen name called J.D. Robb. And she does this futuristic crime series where you're a female homicide detective in New York in like 2057. That's super dark, super guttural, has moments of really, 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 really sexy. And there's, as of now, 52 books in the In Death series. Starts with Naked in Death is the first book. And I'm obsessed. Like all I want to be in life is Lieutenant Eve Dallas.
Oh my goodness, 52 books.
Yeah, dude. I don't know how she writes under both pen names and churns out these books. I don't know how anybody does it. Like, you know, Stephen King and James Patterson. Like, I don't know. God bless them.
You sold me on it, but I need to have started like 5 years ago now at this point, right?
That's the crazy thing is I started 2 years ago and became obsessed, went through it lightning speed. But the books were written, like the first book came out in 1997, and it predicts the iPhone and it predicts the rise of like bath salts as a drug, but it all has different names and it's wild how many things that it has predicted that's manifested.
I'm putting that on my must read list. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. In Death by J.D. Robb starts with Naked in Death.
I'm just surprised it's not a movie or a TV series. Not that you would get through 52 books, but for somebody, that's like a huge project to sink your teeth into.
If I were independently wealthy, or if Jeff Bezos wanted to give me all of his money, I would be more than happy to bring this to viewing audiences. But you know what? Like so many things, like even the Bebop anime, you know, sometimes you love something so desperately and you fantasize about what if it was turned into a live action. And more often than not, the fantasy of what if is better than the manifestation of what is.
So what is next for you, Jay? Do you have anything in the hopper?
I do. So I've got a movie I'm very excited about coming out on Fox's streamer Tubi called Unborn, which I'm a horror movie fanatic. Like I grew up on horror like Mother's Milk. And this is like Rosemary's Baby on steroids.
That movie terrified me. So
we had a whole conversation in the Toys in the Attic episode about horror and how Jamie and our guest Symphony Sanders are just aficionados. And I can't watch one bit.
Yeah, I'm obsessed. I don't know what it is. It's my happy spot. It's my comfort spot.
To that end, we see that you've done some writing, some producing. Are any of those long-term or permanent goals of yours?
You know, it's funny. It never was before. And I sort of fell into it by mistake. I was working as a series regular on a show and sort of, you know, had my opinions as to what it could and should be, as we all do. And on a bold whim, wrote an outline and gave it to the showrunner. And they said, you know what, how do you feel about coming on and writing this with me? To which I was like, yes, yes. But I don't write for myself. So I marginalized my own character. But I got so excited about all these other storylines, all these other characters on the show we were doing. I enjoy writing when there's a good collaborative environment. I don't love being alone. That's why I don't understand how some writers can just write into the wind, staring at a white page with a blinking cursor. Like that is some dark magic I don't understand. But under a collaborative circumstance, like, yeah, I really do enjoy the writing part. And producing, you know, it depends. Like producing on a higher level is different than independent producing. When it comes to the nuts and the bolts of putting the production together and hiring the team and making shortlists and suggestions of locations and department heads, that stuff is exciting. But on an independent level, when you're trying to chase sponsorship, that part was no fun.
Thank you so much, Jade, for being with us today. We've had just a wonderful time. We have learned more than we expected to about Binary Two-Step. If our listeners wanted to see more of your work or find you online, where would you like them to go?
First, thank you so much for having me. Guys, this was a blast. I love this show and I'm devastated that the Bebop ending ends this awesome podcast with you guys. So thank you so much for having me. It really was an honor. And if anybody's interested in what goes on next, or you want to troll me because you're bored, you can hit me up on Instagram at JadeHarlow12. That's probably the best place to fan me.
Ah, dang, there were 11 other Jade Harlows before you.
Yo, I jumped on the train way late, bro. So I'm number 12, but I have an obsession with the number 12. So it works out.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jade. I wish you the best. And I'm going to be dreaming of Mel fanfic for a very long time.
Thanks, Jamie. Lauren, you guys are awesome. I really appreciate the time.
Join us next time for Galileo Hustle, our favorite episode of the Netflix Cowboy Bebop, we'll be talking to stunt coordinator Alan Poppleton. Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.